If you ask any value-based care leader in the field of musculoskeletal medicine and orthopedic surgery, who got them inspired to go into value-based care, they are going to say one name, and that is Dr. Kevin Bozick. We are so excited to kick off our Value Shift podcast with him as our first guest. And fittingly so, he's the one who inspired me back in 2007 to get into value-based care. So without further ado, we're going to get started with the episode. I'm going to flash on the screen some of his many accolades, including being the former president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And without further ado, let's start learning from his insights about the past, present, and future of orthopedic value-based care.
So really excited to have Dr. Kevin Bozick joining us today. Kevin has been my mentor since 2007 and taught me all my foundations and pretty much everything I know about value-based care in orthopedics and beyond. And so we're really excited to have you, Kevin, and thank you for taking the time to meet with us and share your wisdom and expertise with us as well. So really appreciate you joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. I'm very proud of all that you've accomplished in your career, Eric, and you've been certainly one of the leaders and strongest voices in this area.
Very nice of you to say. And the goal today is we're going to just talk about some of the topics around value-based care, especially as it relates to, what specialists and orthopedic surgeons can do to advance the topic. And so I'll kick it off with the first question. What is your current role and title and your day-to-day job as it is today?
Yeah, so I have a number of roles, but my primary professional role is as professor and chair of surgery and perioperative care at the Dell Medical School at UT Austin. And then I have roles within our National Professional Society and other things. But where I spend my day-to-day time is, first of all and foremost, the thing I enjoy the most is taking care of patients. And I do that several days a week. And then I run $100 million a year organization that employs 57 physicians and about 200 staff and spans 13 different disciplines, clinical disciplines, and 32 distinct clinical programs, three residency programs, four different research units. And I would say the part of my job that I spend the most time on is mentorship and developing leaders. And what I just described, because I came here, I was employee number one. There was nobody else here. To get from there to where we are today, there's no way I could do that myself, obviously. Finding, recruiting, retaining, as I mentioned earlier, that I'm proud of, and then mentoring and developing those leaders like Carl Koenig and others is what I spend the bulk of my time on, and helping them be more effective leaders. And that's the part of the job I enjoy the most.
As you've progressed through your career, you've obviously helped shape value-based care in the musculoskeletal space for a lot with a big impact across different initiatives. And, in your opinion, what really does orthopedic value-based care entail as it is today, and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in order to answer that question, you have to start with defining the term. And I think the term has been used in a lot of different ways by a lot of different people. I'm sort of a purist, and I go back to the origins of the term value-based healthcare, and it came from Michael Porter and Elizabeth Teichberg's book, Redefining Healthcare, in 2006, where they really laid out a framework for competition based on value delivered to patients, where value is defined as health outcomes achieved per dollar spent to achieve those outcomes. As that relates to musculoskeletal care, it means a focus on the health outcomes that matter to patients, in our case, pain, functional status, quality of life, and what it takes us in terms of resources, people, care delivery organization to achieve those outcomes. So in order to do that, you have to be able to define those outcomes and measure them. If you can't measure your improvements in health, you can't measure or improve value. And you have to understand what it costs you in terms of resources, people, delivery organization to achieve those outcomes.
So what role do you think orthopedic surgeons play in promoting and advancing value-based care?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. I would say first and foremost, a realization and an emphasis on what the purpose of the work that we do is and what are the outcomes that matter. So we spend a lot of time measuring adverse events and bad things that happen to people, utilization of imaging procedures and other things, and we lose sight of the fact that the reason our industry exists is to improve quality of life and function and reduce pain. So probably the first and foremost thing orthopedic surgeons can do is advocate for measuring the things that matter most to patients, and whether that means within their organization, within their payer contracts, within their partnerships, really having a laser focus on understanding, measuring, and improving the outcomes that matter to patients.
And, you know, I've visited you all recently and saw the clinic that you have at DelMed. Could you give kind of a brief overview of the, you know, the integrated practice unit that you've set up at Dell and how you work with the risk-bearing organization and how you put that all together? Because I'm sure a lot of people may know about it, but may not know some of the overview and details about it.
Yeah, so if you look at sort of the core principles laid out by Porter and Teisberg in their work, one of the things that they talked about in order to create value is we have to organize care around conditions rather than physician specialty. So patients present with conditions, in our case, musculoskeletal conditions. And in order to treat those conditions, it requires a team of people with different skill sets. So if we only have orthopedic surgeons or physiatrists or physical therapists focusing in a silo on treating the musculoskeletal health, we're going to miss out on that opportunity to complement each other's skills. And so what we did is we started by looking at what are the most common disciplines involved in the treatment of musculoskeletal care. It was really primary care or some version of primary care, which doesn't even need to be a physician, musculoskeletal health experts. In our case, we use physician assistants, nurse practitioners, chiropractors, and physical therapists. And they're the front line of the care. And then we have to have people that understand the behavioral health and mental health aspects of musculoskeletal illness and disease and recovery. And so we have mental health professionals. In our case, we use behavioral health trained social workers, but there are other people that are equally skilled in treating the and understanding the mental health aspects of musculoskeletal disease and recovery. And then we have people that are experts in lifestyle modification, things like weight loss, activity. And then we have people that do interventions. So whether it be chiropractors, physiatrists, rheumatologists, or orthopedic surgeons. And all of those people are involved in the care of musculoskeletal disease. So when you organize care in that way, not only do you have available at your fingertips all the skill sets that you need to optimally manage the condition, it also facilitates better learning because you can, as you, instead of doing those things in silos, you can actually see a cause and effect by what the intervention that the team provides on the outcome. And also leads to greater provider and clinician satisfaction because you're focusing on the things that you're uniquely good at and enjoy and trained to do, and not the things that come along with managing musculoskeletal disease that you might not be as skilled at.
If you want to learn more about the Dell Medical School's value-based healthcare immersion program that Dr. Bozek leads, there's a link to that program below, so I encourage you to check it out. Also, if you want to stay posted with Proterra's value-based specialty care news, podcasts, and events, please subscribe to our newsletter below as well.
Awesome. And, you know, I'm sure you get this question a lot, but like the genesis of that clinic, it required a lot of participation and coordination with the risk-bearing entity. To the extent that you can, you know, disclose or share, how did that all kind of come about and come to fruition? And what is the, like, the patient experience of, like, going through it compared to a typical fee-for-service when they're ping-ponging around everywhere?
Yeah, it's a great question. We realized early on that if we wanted to organize care around conditions, we need to have a financial incentive that aligned with that. Otherwise, we would be being paid for things that don't align with the way that we're providing care and providing care that doesn't align with the way we're being paid. So we established what we call a condition-based longitudinal payment model with our local county health district, which was our initial and still one of our largest customers. So these are the most vulnerable patients that have the most complex medical and social needs. And we decided that rather than in the fee-for-service world where we have to go for prior authorization on every individual service that we provide, whether it be cognitive behavioral therapy, whether it be physical therapy, whether it be lifestyle modification, orthopedic surgery, injections, imaging, that we would bundle all those together and actuarially determine what percentage of patients with a musculoskeletal diagnosis require those services, and then aggregate those in a way that we could be paid for the episode of care, which is managing that condition longitudinally, and then obviate the need for any type of prior authorization, and then similarly be focused on being held accountable for the outcome that matters to patients. So it was tied to patient-reported outcome measurement. And that, again, has allowed us to be financially viable, and it's also allowed us to focus on what matters to our patients and not what matters to health plans.
So these episode-based bundles, these integrated practice units, they all seem so thoughtful and so forward-thinking. Why are they not more widespread today? What do you think the biggest challenge is?
Yeah, great question. I think in part, it's we know what we know. So it's a lack of awareness and experience, you know, that most of us that trained in a musculoskeletal specialty, whether it be physiatry, rheumatology, physical therapy, chiropractic, podiatry, orthopedic surgery, it's baked into our training that we're trained to practice by specialty. So that's a big part of it, is just our historically the way care has been designed and the way that clinicians, whether you be physicians or not, are trained and raised. Another is the incentives. So again, as I mentioned, if you are providing care in a coordinated way to optimize outcomes, that implies that you'll actually be doing things that aren't even paid for or covered in a fee-for-service world. For instance, providing cognitive behavioral therapy for someone with chronic knee arthritis is not a covered benefit, and you have to have a payment model that aligns with those incentives. And then that just requires a certain amount of inertia to overcome the existing way that care is delivered and paid for. So I would say, if you were to ask me what's the biggest impediment, it's a lack of leadership, lack of clinician leadership, lack of health plan leadership, and lack of stakeholder leadership in general, and really willingness to embrace change.
And so, you know, you talk about how we're trained, and Mal and I, as you are, we're all orthopedic surgeons, we're trained to deliver care and siloed, right, in our practices. You have educated many, countless people on value-based care, but how did you kind of even learn about these concepts as you went through? Could you walk us through, and I'm actually kind of curious about this, like your career progression. I know some of the first studies I read about from you that I read were about cost-effectiveness research, and obviously that's the tip of the spear, but how did you even get, you know, learning yourself on these topics, and how have you progressed, and who have you turned to kind of, or has it been mostly experience and trial and error?
Yeah, no, it's an important point. I was very fortunate, and it was somewhat fortuitous that in my first year in my MBA at Harvard Business School, which both of you have done, my required curriculum professor in the first year for competition and strategy was Michael Porter. So that's where I first started learning the concepts of competition and strategy being defined as the decisions that you make to differentiate yourself from competition by increasing value to the customer. And at this point, this was 2000, and Michael Porter had not yet gotten interested in healthcare and had not yet written his book, Redefining Healthcare. So initially in my career, I started thinking about some of the things that I learned in business school, which for me was transformative, and I'm sure was for both of you as well, but it changed my entire outlook and how I think about the world, how I think about healthcare, and how I think about my own career. And I started applying some of the things that I learned in that context. And it started with, yes, looking at things like efficiency, utilization, cost effectiveness. But then when Porter's book came out, I said, wow, this is actually much broader than looking at the cost of healthcare. And it actually completely flipped my mentality from focusing on the cost of healthcare to focusing on the outcomes that matter to patients. And so at that point, I started really trying to do my best to promote the use of patient-reported outcome measures in routine clinical practice. And that was 2007. Took us more than a decade to get that. Actually, Eric, you helped us participate in this when we developed an AAUS work group to develop a task force to help clinicians implement measurement of patient-reported outcomes in routine clinical practice. And then from there, I ultimately founded the AOS Healthcare Systems Committee because I realized there was a lot of interest, but a lack of expertise and coordination and organization around our efforts within the musculoskeletal world to create competition based on value. So that committee really, that was something I proposed to the AUS board of directors and got funded. And then that really became the launching pad to my career in leadership within the AUS. And then in 2014, I stumbled across an opportunity here in Austin, Texas, to join a new medical school that was focused on revolutionizing the way people get and stay healthy. And that really gave me the platform to come here and redesign the education system, the targets of our research, and most importantly, the way we design, deliver, and measure the impact of clinical care. And that's led to all of the opportunities I've had since then were based on coming here to Austin. In the meantime, I did have a lot of opportunities and still do to work with large health plans, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, large employer coalitions like the Purchaser Business Group on Health, the National Business Group on Health, other stakeholders that are interested in transforming the way we deliver and pay for healthcare.
And last question, kind of on that teaching front, which is obviously, you know, your expertise is probably second to none in this. And if you wouldn't mind, if you could share a little bit about the immersion program that you have right now at the med school, which I participated in, but it was during COVID time, so it was virtual when I did it. But I'm sure a lot of people would love to hear about how they could learn about what you guys are doing at Del Med and bring that back to their own home institutions.
Well, thanks for the plug. We started in 2016 when the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation was looking at various examples of innovative payment and delivery models. They heard about our condition-based longitudinal payment plan. And so they sent a group from Baltimore and Washington, which at the time they didn't have a travel ban like they do now. And they sent a whole team of people to Austin to investigate what we were doing. And so we spent several months organizing all of the different facets from our payment model to our delivery model to our predictive analytics to our how we assess the impact. And that took months to develop. And then we put on basically a 24-hour program starting at noon on a Thursday till noon on a Friday. And when we got done with that, we thought, wow, we have so many people that come to us and say, hey, I want to learn more about what you're doing in Austin. Can I come visit you? And we'd say, no, that's not a really good way to understand what we're doing in Austin because it's incredibly resource intensive on our part. And you're not going to gain much from walking around in clinic with me for a day. So we said, what if we, on a quarterly or biannual basis, pulled that same team together and brought people here and immersed them in a team and a philosophy that delivers care based on value delivered to patients? And that led to the title, which is called the Musculoskeletal Institute Value-Based Healthcare Immersion Program, where you immerse yourself in our team, embed yourself on our team, and learn from each member of our team, including the clinicians, the contracting people, and the people behind the scenes in the predictive analytic world, our data infrastructure, and really try to do it in an efficient way so that you can spend 24 hours here with us and learn as much as possible. And it's been incredibly rewarding for us. And we've been doing that for, I think, 9 years now. And we've been able to find like-minded people all over the country and in some cases all over the world. We've had people from Europe, from Asia that have come to share ideas. And it's also multidisciplinary in nature in that we have health plans that come, we have device and pharmaceutical companies that come because they all bring a unique perspective to how we optimize value for patients.
You've had such a kind of storied career in orthopedics, you know, in orthopedics and policy and leadership, technical training and everything. And, you know, you and Eric have literally written the book on value-based care and taught myself and most of the country what we know about orthopedic and value-based care. What motivates you to keep innovating and leading in this space?
Good question. I would say, just like all of us who are clinicians, it's the impact on our patients and the ability to produce results and improve people's quality of life. So I realized early on. I think Eric asked in one of his first questions, and I didn't answer, what's the impact on patients? The type of experience that our patients have and the way that they communicate to us about their experience in being a part of a multidisciplinary team that's focused on the outcomes that matter to them is transformative for our patients. I have patients that I previously saw in a more traditional environment and I've now seen in this environment, and they share the experience that it's night and day for them, to the point where many times they're in tears over how different it is and how impactful it is. And at the same time, the part that came to me later in my career was the impact it's had on my team and the retention rate and turnover. So I was recently doing some digging on data and feedback for my annual performance review with my boss. And I found out that since I've been here in Austin, I've recruited 57 full-time faculty in 10 years since 2015. And all 57 faculty are still here. Not a single person has left in 10 years. And that's not because I'd like to think I'm a great leader, but it's not because I'm a great leader. It's because they get to wake up every day and do what they enjoy doing. And they know that ultimately they are doing what they were trained to do and love doing, which is helping people improve the quality of their life.
That's pretty impressive. 57 out of 57 is no small feat.
I almost lost one about 2 weeks ago, and I had to counter an offer they had from a competitive institution. And just to be transparent, I ended up offering them less money in a more expensive city, and they stayed. And I asked them why, and they said the culture, and that was the reason they stayed. So they could have left for more money and a lower cost of living at a big, well-known institution, but they decided to stay because of the culture.
We had one kind of final question for you is, as you, you know, reflect on your career and what you've accomplished, what would you say you're most proud of, and what gets you excited about the road ahead?
I would say I'm most proud of the generation of leaders, which includes both of you, that have come along behind me, that have carried the torch, that have taught me things and have inspired me to continue this work. I think if I had started this work and it was a dead end and nobody really got behind it, I probably would have pivoted by now. But it's inspiring for me to wake up. Interestingly, every Monday and Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. Pacific, I do a mentorship call with someone somewhere around the country. And I have, my assistant knows that I have those slots available. And this morning I spoke to a woman who immigrated here from Africa and is now a medical student at Northwestern and interested in a career in orthopedic surgery, and was fascinated by the work that we do and wanted to understand and learn more about value-based healthcare. And if I think of, I've been doing those calls every Monday and Wednesday since probably 2006 or seven, probably the first time you and I met, Eric, was on one of those calls, I suspect. And if you multiply that by 45 weeks a year times two and 20 years, that's a lot of people. And then there's a lot of other people that you have trained and PJ has trained and Carl have trained and the whole legacy of the U.S. Healthcare Systems Committee, all of these other people that have taken it to a new level. That's probably what inspires me the most. And if I would say what I would want as a legacy and what I would like to accomplish with whatever time is remaining in my career, it's really to tackle the implementation side. We've done so much work on the policy side, and we have research, and we have lots of people nod their head and say, that's a great idea. Like Mel said earlier, why isn't everybody doing this? There are really tangible challenges and obstacles that have to be overcome to implement. And so I would focus the balance of my career on the implementation science side. And that's where we need an army and a generation of leaders like both of you to help with that work.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your expertise. Super excited that you were able to join us, and we look forward to keep learning from you. That wraps it up. I appreciate this.
Yeah. Thanks again for including me, and really just impressed with the work that you guys are doing and all of your efforts to promote these concepts and principles. So appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you guys soon.